Now here is Bill Resnick and Bill Smaldone concluding their three-part series on how fascists took power in Germany and its significance for thinking about strategy today.
Bill Smaldone, welcome to KABU.
Hello, Bill.
Bill Smaldone's an activist and organizer in Salem, Oregon. He served 4 years as a radical on the Salem City Council. He also co-founded Radio KMUZ. It's a new KABU-like station in Salem. And he's on the editorial board of the Salem Weekly, an alternative paper. In his other life, Bill makes a living teaching history at Willamette University. His specialty is Germany in the 20th century and ongoing. He writes a lot. His latest book is European Socialism, A Concise History. And before that, he wrote Confronting Hitler on the tragic failure of the German left to deal with Hitler, to stop Hitler and his Nazi party from gaining political power in Germany in the 1930s. I've interviewed Bill Smaldone several times in the last 6 months on Hitler and his National Socialist Party, the Nazis, how they rose to power in Germany, and how a far right-wing party could gain power here if we are unable to solve this country's and, in fact, the world's problems. Bill, today we agreed to talk about two things. First, the role of violence in the Nazi rise to power in Germany, both violence by the right and by the left. And second, we'll talk about violence today, also by the right and by the left. That is violence today, right now, at the beginning of the Trump era. Bill, tell us about violence by the Nazis and violence by the left in the Nazi rise to power.
Well, it's a long and complicated story, but you really need to go back to the revolution of 1918 to get a sense of what was going on in Germany in the interwar years. The imperial government was brought down by a violent revolution in 1918. It was a revolution of workers and soldiers against a military dictatorship. And in the fall of 1918, in the wake of a naval mutiny that basically spread across the country, these workers and soldiers overthrew the military dictatorship and established a new revolutionary government. And that revolutionary government was based in two institutions. One institution was the Revolutionary Workers and Soldiers Council, and the other institution was a provisional government that was made up of the two existing socialist parties, the Socialist Party and the Independent Socialist Party. What eventually transpires is that the councils give power over to the provisional government, and you have the emergence of a socialist provisional government in the fall of 1918.
The workers' councils were really running the cities. These were radically democratic organizations.
Correct, and they were armed. So whoever has the guns basically wins the revolution. Right? And so the armed workers and soldiers, because they had guns and because the army was discredited, were able to seize power, and then they handed over to the provisional government. Right in the wake of that, forces on the right in the country begin to reorganize. People who feared the spread of Bolshevism from the Russian Revolution, people who were afraid of radical transformation in Germany. And many of these people organized in new paramilitary units and in underground organizations and began to launch attacks on the left. And these included widespread assassination of government officials. Once the Republic got on its feet, in 1918 and 1919, it established a kind of democratic parliamentary system. And over the course of the first 3 or 4 years of the Republic's existence, hundreds of Republican officials were gunned down by right-wing radicals.
And left leaders and union leaders.
That's right. There was a lot of overlap there between union leaders and left leaders and government officials. And these right-wing organizations were violently opposed to the Republic, and this violence was exercised through the process of assassination.
Why was the provisional government unable to protect itself?
Well, the provisional government was able to protect itself to the degree in which it could recruit military forces, and this is a great contradiction, right? Because the socialists turned to the old army, which consisted of nothing but reactionaries, really, to defend itself against all comers on the right, the far right, and on the left, because they feared disorder and they feared the rise of Bolshevism. They were quite petrified of the spread of Bolshevism into Germany. So the upshot of it was that you had a government that was defending itself against right-wing radicals on the one side that hated the new democratic parliamentary order, and you also had people on the left, concentrated on the far left in the Communist Party, who wished to overthrow the Democratic Republic and replace it with a Soviet-style republic. And so the government would use military forces from the old regime to put down the radical left, And it also used its police forces to round up, as far as it could, the assassins on the right. The problem was that when people came before the courts, the revolutionaries on the left were often punished much more severely than the revolutionaries or the counter-revolutionaries on the right. Most of the people on the right were treated with kid gloves because the courts were peopled by reactionaries held over from the old regime. So the government failed to purge many of the institutions of the old system.
Like Hitler, in fact, who staged this ridiculous coup in his attempt at a revolution and was, in fact, just sort of accepted.
That's right. In 1923, he attempted to overthrow the Bavarian government and march on Berlin. And that was put down by local police forces, and he was arrested. And he was tried for treason and convicted, and he received a 5-year sentence, but only served 9 months. And it was a very nice 9 months. When he was in prison, he was well-treated. On the other hand, many people on the left who were involved in revolutionary activity against the state were arrested. Many were executed or sentenced to very long prison terms. So there was a definite tilt favoring the radical right in the German courts.
There was also some violence by the left. You pointed out that there was a group of the communists who thought that they could make a revolution, a Soviet-style revolution, and then align with this great force that they still believed in, the Soviet Union, the Russians.
That's correct. You know, they tried several times to overthrow the republic. Each time, they were more ignominiously defeated. They just didn't have the weaponry or the numbers to carry out what they wanted to do. The other thing one should remember is that as the political system took shape, each of the political parties that organized set up its own paramilitary formations to fight the other political parties who challenged them. So as the Nazis mobilized, for example, they created a street fighting organization called the Brown Shirts. These were guys who wore brown uniforms, and they defended the party's rallies, and they attacked the rallies of their opponents, and they were really tough street fighters. The left produced its own paramilitary formations. The communists had their own, and so did the socialists. The socialists had a thing called the Reichsbanner, which was an organization that consisted of hundreds of thousands of pro-Republican activists who were organized along paramilitary lines and who defended the Social Democratic Party's interests in the streets, literally against the opponents on the left and the right. So on the one hand, you have the official government policing forces that are active, operating against the left and the right, but you also have these non-governmental paramilitary units attached to the political parties who create chaos in the streets. And the Nazis were very effective at doing this. As time went on and their organization grew, they used the paramilitary units on the one hand to sow chaos, but on the other hand to demonstrate how they would be forces of order if they came to power. So they were very highly disciplined. They did not attack enemy formations willy-nilly. They only did so in accordance with the orders from above, and they were generally used on a day-to-day basis to demonstrate the Nazis as a force of order against the chaos brought about by the Republic. So when many middle-class people feared the coming of communism, the Nazis basically tried to show that they would be a force of order that would defend against communist chaos.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mill Variety Hour. I'm talking to Bill Smaldone. We're talking about the rise of the Nazis in Germany in the late 20s and 30s, culminating in their winning an election, the Nazis. Bill, left violence really did not work very well. In fact, in Germany, they were really trapped because they had to set up their own violent units to try and protect themselves because, in fact, the police and army and courts were run by reactionaries. It's not clear what they could have done, actually, although had they unified the entire left, they might have succeeded. What's your sense of that, actually?
Well, you know, a lot depends on the condition of the institutions of the state, and what the socialists needed to do was to do a much more thoroughgoing job in creating democratic state institutions that got rid of the holdovers of the old dictatorial regime. That would have been a huge step forward. You need reliable state institutions who can maintain order against violent extremists who are assailing it. And this was a big problem in the Weimar Republic. You had police units that were not reliable. You had military units that were not reliable.
In fact, who were infiltrated by the Nazis.
That's especially true
often.
In the Army. That's right. It's a little bit more complicated when you think about the Social Democrats controlling Prussia, which was one of the big German states, and they controlled Prussia for many years, and they controlled the Prussian police for many years, and they attempted to transform the police, but it took them way too long, and they were not thoroughgoing enough, so that when the Nazis took the police over in 1933, they were able to pretty quickly Nazify the police department and use it as their own instrument. So the Nazis actually learned quite a bit from the mistakes of the Republicans. Where the Republicans hesitated, the Nazis did not, and they purged the state institutions of any perceived opponents very quickly, whereas the Republicans were afraid of civil war, and they hesitated. And that was a huge mistake on their part.
Germany was one case. You're also familiar with the English case, where the Nazis, in fact, tried to organize in exactly the same way and were defeated. I think we should talk about that and how the Nazis were defeated in England. Some right. people who think that violence really works, violence by the left, point out that there were struggles and, in fact, some victories by the left who were suppressing the Nazis in the street and beating them down. But that wasn't really the way that the English basically ended the threat of Nazism. Why don't you tell us the story?
Well, I mean, you know, you have the Cable Street fight in 1936, which was a battle in which the left, led by anarchist forces in part, against a fascist political demonstration in a Jewish neighborhood in London. In that particular case, you had a very large turnout for the left against a much smaller fascist group. And they were able to defeat the fascists in a street fight. And that was to their credit, of course. But the thing is, I would not then assert that the reason why fascism in England failed is because fascism was defeated in street fighting. There are complicated reasons why fascism did not take off in England. It has a lot to do with British political culture, with long and very different political traditions and institutions in England than you had in Central Europe. And so, as a historian, I'm very leery of asserting that, well, because the left was able to defeat the fascists in one big street fight in 1936, that shows that using the fist, okay, that using violence in the streets against Nazis is what you need to do to defeat them. I would argue that that is an oversimplification of what actually occurred, that what you need is strong democratic institutions, and you need to do, in fact, as they did, you need to mobilize lots of people and channel those mobilizations against the right, okay, but you don't need to resort to force in the streets to do so.
Well, in fact, it seems to me that force in the streets can really backfire and, in fact, strengthen the right, as I think it is now in the United States when some small groups do attack not just the Nazis but also the police who are protecting the Nazis' right to free speech.
I would agree. First of all, I'm very leery about any attempts by the left to try to match the right's ability to bring guns to bear, right? One of my big worries is that there will be a confrontation or confrontations in the United States in which armed paramilitary forces use their weapons. If that becomes part of our political culture, we are in deep doo-doo.
Yeah, well, the police are, unfortunately, who have been infiltrated, are using their weapons, actually, although with some control and having to justify it.
Well, what I would say in response to that is it's our job to force the civilian institutions, right, that oversee the police to bring the police to heel and make them use their weapons in ways that are proper, right, and defend people's rights to demonstrate.
Yeah, I would even go further than that, and I'm sure you do. What we have to do is force the police to only hire and train and be careful about maintaining the ethic of sort of constitutionalism, that is, they have to support the Bill of Rights and they have to support civilian control of police and army. Yeah. And in the absence of that, well, you get a police state.
I couldn't agree more. That would be where I would place my emphasis. So I'm quite concerned. I know that there was a big rally up in Portland recently in which the right attempted to demonstrate there, I think, against Sharia law. This was on June 10th. And there was a much larger counter-demonstration, which was good. And the counter-demonstration, I think, you know, really overshadowed the right's effort. But one of the things that really disturbed me was that the Oath Keepers organization, which is an armed paramilitary group that is opposed to the Constitution, they escorted the right-wing demonstrators during the demonstration. And that I find to be highly disturbing. And I'm concerned that the police will not be able to control the use of violence by the right. I'm also concerned about, you know, the appearance of the Black Bloc and the role of Black Bloc elements in some of the demonstrations that have occurred. But I'm much more worried about the armed paramilitaries on the right.
Bill, why don't you summarize fairly briefly your sense of the need to maintain a civil society that will put down right-wing efforts and how to do that?
So I would say that if you look at the two big examples, if you look at the German example of 1933, and if you look at the Austrian example of 1934, in both cases you see socialist movements that are defeated by fascist movements, even though the socialists have very large membership roles and they have large paramilitary formations that they try to use to defend their interests in the streets. And the reason why they lose in both cases is that they don't have control over state power. Even though the states were both ostensibly parliamentary states, were actually under the control of people who were not interested in preserving the constitutional democratic order. And therefore, the institutions of the republic were not reliable. And once that became clear, that opened the road, really, to the fascists to take power. And so in our struggles here in the United States, it seems to me that we have to mobilize forces in the streets, okay, to put pressure not only on the groups against whom we're trying to do battle, so against the far right, but we want to keep pressure on the state to make sure that the state consists of institutions that respond, right, to the people's needs in democratic constitutional ways, right? That is essential. It's especially true in regard to the police. So it's important that we, on the left, mobilize large numbers of people, as many as we can, and get them into the streets and get them into the process and force the state to respond in the ways that we want. We want a democratic state that can maintain order, but do so in a way that is constitutional and gives everybody the ability to demonstrate as they wish.
We have to act strongly. This is not just sort of a nice middle-class pacifist movement. We have to be strong. We have to be in the streets. But we also have to be educated. We have to build movements based on ideas. And we have to build movements that are based on ideas of a better life for those in the United States, majority of people who are now downwardly mobile. And we have to build movements that give them a voice and are actually democratic. It seems to me that when you talk about the state, you're really talking about a very different kind of state that those movements would have to create. And a state that doesn't, in fact, provide riches to a very small minority now, it's quite remarkable, and precariousness for all of the rest. That is real fear and anxiety at your heartbeat away from destitution, at least, and at minimum, humiliation, having to rely on, who knows, your relatives or something. It's very fearsome now out in the United States. We need a very different kind of, and you can call it a state, but it's really the sort of the aggregate of the desires and institutions of working people.
We need a movement, Bill, that is not just against things, right, but is for things, right? And so you're talking about the larger picture in which we mobilize people who recognize that the system is not working for average people. And we mobilize them in such a way that they are not just against the powers that be or against the far right, but are for something that represents a major improvement over what we now have. We have to really do two things at once. We have to fight against efforts to undermine the democratic republic that now exists. We also have to use the terrain of the democratic republic to build something better. And that's a huge challenge, right? But that's exactly what you're talking about. We have to educate people about what their options are.
And activate them around those options.
Yes, that's right.
Bill, good talking to you again.
As always, Bill, great talking to you.
There are all sorts of terribly worrying things happening in the world. On the other hand, things are going to change. The way the U.S. operates now is unsustainable in so many ways. There's lots of room for talking about alternatives now. So thanks for talking to us today.
Right. Let me conclude by saying that it's a moment of great concern, but it's also a moment of great opportunity. I'm hoping that the left can use the opportunity skillfully and successfully.
Me too. Add me to that list, Bill.
Great.
Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Right.
Bye-bye.